Today's episode is sponsored by Datadog, a modern full-stack monitoring platform for cloud infrastructure, applications, and logs metrics all in one place. From their recent report on serverless adoption and trends, Datadog found half their customer base using EC2s have now adopted AWS Lambda. They've examined real-world serverless usage by thousands of companies running on millions of distinct serverless functions, and they found that half of the Lambda invocations run for less than 800 milliseconds. You can easily monitor all your serverless functions in one place and generate serverless metrics straight from Datadog. Check it out yourself by signing up for a free 14-day trial and get a free t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/Hanselminutes Show to get started. That's datadog.com/Hanselminutes Show to get started. Hey, this is Scott Hansel, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm here with Chris Connor, who's coming off of season two of Altered Carbon. How are you, sir?
Quite well. And yourself?
I am living the dream right now, and I'm very, very happy to be chatting with you. My wife and I, you know how when you love a show so much that it's like, do I binge it? And then I've done this to myself. Then The show isn't a thing you've absorbed. It's a thing you've done to yourself.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, what have I done to myself? Yeah. But you love it so much, you also want to watch other people watch the show.
That's fascinating.
So I want to put an ad on Craigslist or something where I can say, come and watch this show so I can watch you watch the show.
There's nothing creepy about that.
No, I don't know. But it's because I want them to go, oh, and then turn.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, I know.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
It's interesting that we haven't come up with like Skype parties for watching shows yet.
Why can't I just call someone, say, let's push the 1, 2, 3, hit the clapper, and we... Yeah. Synchronize our show.
Yeah.
So we can have reactions to each other about why this show is so great.
That's a great idea.
I'm just saying. We could go ahead and patent that right now.
Okay.
So Altered Carbon, I read the books. I've watched the show. And you play, and for the context for the folks that are listening who may not have watched the show, I would encourage you to pause right now and run off and see that. I can't guarantee there won't be any spoilers, but there'll certainly be thematic spoilers. But if I may, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. The general structure of this is that in the future, there are these things called stacks, which are effectively USB keys for people that hold DHF, digital human freight. And digital human freight is you in a thing that goes into the back of the neck, and it allows us to do things like, what's it called, narrowcast?
Mm-hmm. Needlecast.
Needlecast. You can go and basically beam yourself to another planet because it's too tedious to get on a ship and fly there. We'll just upload you to the other planet. Of course, you'd have to put yourself on ice so that your sleeve, your body is not... double sleeved. You don't want to have Chris in two planets at once.
Yeah.
And then it will certainly, if you apply capitalism to that, then really rich people will have the very best backups.
Yep.
Everyone's in the cloud, and then you'll never die.
Exactly.
So then people who don't ever die are called meths, which is like Methuselah from the Bible.
Exactly.
Okay. But you don't play any of those people.
No. I'm an artificial intelligent life form that has taken the existent form of Edgar Allan Poe.
Is the identity of the artificial intelligence that you play intrinsically attached to Edgar Allan Poe? Did he exist in a void and then decided this? Did he pick his sleeve?
Yes. And for all intents and purposes, the artificial intelligent life form I play has gone through many different versions. When people watch the show, they'll see... the floor of the Hotel Raven, which I am the hotel. The hotel is me, an artificial intelligent life form that is serving humans as a hotel. That floor looks like an M.C. Escher piece of art. At some point, my artificial intelligent life form toyed with being Escher. In the books, Richard Morgan wrote the hotel as the Hendrix, based on Jimi Hendrix. Fortunately for me, they couldn't get the rights from the Hendrix estate. So they ended up settling on Poe for the television show. And it's been a joy to be able to play someone with such depth and romanticism and darkness.
And the fact that there is that backstory, I think, actually expands. It makes it even more interesting because Hendrix was certainly complicated, but Poe is a well of background information.
Yeah. You know, when we started... it all the process was very quick when we began. I got cast and I was pretty much shipped off to Canada. We shot in Vancouver, BC, and immediately diving into all of Poe's work, I knew, you know, quite a bit from college and growing up reading a little bit of Poe, but to actually delve into his letters, his life, it really started to flesh out the idea of what the character and the true wants of this character are in our world as far as the television show goes.
Poe in his life was a profoundly prolific but also an incredibly sad individual. Like, he couldn't catch a break.
Yeah, utter abject failure. He distanced himself from most members of the artistic community by being a bit of an ass, had many enemies, and almost every female in his life tragically died. And then, of course, he tragically died, and we're still not sure how the circumstances of his death, but he was beaten to death and found in another man's clothes on the streets in Baltimore, incredibly drunk on laudanum. So it's a tragic end.
You mentioned that he had issues with the women in his life,
yeah.
His mom, his wife. Any relationship with women was bad, or they died.
Yeah, his mom died right at the very beginning of his life. She was an actress, ironically. Then he was adopted. That woman who adopted him, who for all intents and purposes was probably the most stable woman in his life, mm-hmm. She died. He ends up marrying his cousin, who happens to be 14 at the time. Years later, she dies. You could say the guy just couldn't catch a break, but he didn't necessarily put himself in the best position because he was a heavy substance abuser.
Yeah. Yeah. He did not make good decisions.
Yeah.
There's a depth to the AI of Poe in the show, but you didn't bring, I felt, the pain. I didn't feel like there was a pain in the AI of Poe. There was a longing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, if you go back and read all of Poe's work, that was the thing that I gleaned specifically, was this longing, this romanticism. Even in The Mask of Red Death, which is such a beautiful story, at the very end, it's this almost tranquil calming. I guess that's not necessarily a good reference in these times of...
Tranquil calm.
Yeah. But you really see this. There's almost a sweetness to it, and I think he distills that in his poetry, probably better than any American writer.
I like that you said that there's almost a sweetness to it, because there's a lot of relationships that Poe the AI in Altered Carbon has, primarily with women.
Yeah,
that are incredibly sweet, and I kept waiting. Because I guess I watch too much TV and I'm just assuming something bad is going to happen, for some gaze, something lurid or uncomfortable. And it never came.
Yeah.
Which made me feel that Poe's, as an AI, his relationships with other AIs and with people was chaste and kind, but there's still a longing, but he doesn't know what he longs for.
Yeah. The searching for what human existence is probably the biggest quest for Poe's life in the television show. And within that, he ends up having a young ward that he needs to rehabilitate named Lizzie. And when we started to play with that character in the first season, it was my job not to make it lurid. And you want to be able to root for this character. And as soon as something as disgusting as that comes through, like this male gaze that's not that's utterly horrifying towards a young woman, you want to try to push against that and make sure it's really almost a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah, and to your credit, and I really appreciate how kind and nurturing and father-like, uncle-like, but there was also there's a peer relationship there, because it isn't a simply I am a parental figure in your life, because there's a time where that switches and Miss Elizabeth is really leading you, Poe,
yeah,
through an adventure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
almost more sophisticated, more emotionally whole than, you know, in her journey.
Totally, totally. When she flees at the end of season one, spoiler, when I cast her upon the array, it is a huge jump for her. It's the big life decision that then propels the rest of the story and the ending of season one. yeah, it's a beautiful little storyline between two characters that could get very complex, but I think is at the end of the day is a story about love.
Mm-hmm. And she is a person who is uploaded into the machine, and she has for a while no physical body, and then she eventually can move around into synthetic sleeves.
Yeah, yeah. Right. We have synths too, which is a whole other different part of Altered Carbon, which mm-hmm. is really exciting. And if we do get a season three, that would be really fun to play with.
Yeah, it would be interesting to understand. Now, your character is an AI, but you're not that kind of typical AI that's like a red dot on the you know, it's like you're not a disembodied AI like yeah. in Travelers.
Or something, yeah.
You're not HAL. You have a body, but it's a nano swarm of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. We played with the idea of, in season two, we definitely play with the idea of hologram form and then actual nano swarm form. So tangible things like my shotgun are achievable in the nanoswarm form, and then in the holographic form, we can play with the idea of being present intellectually, but not being there physically. Which, what does that do to our main character, Takeshi Kovacs, whom I'm in service of?
Right, and then Kovacs eventually starts carrying you around, or a projector that enables him to quote unquote carry you around. So then, yeah. those times you are a projection.
Yeah,
but when you are the hotel is you. Yeah. You can be in a nanoswarm. You can physically pick things up and hand it to people.
Yes, and that that changes throughout the season, which is really fascinating. And to see what we could do with that technology in the third season would be really fun.
Mm-hmm. The idea that you're playing an AI, though, but there's 30, 40 years of AIs in film. How do you make sure that you don't fall into a trope, an AI trope, an obvious, easy trope?
That's such a good question. I was such a huge fan of so many of those people who played AIs. Brett Spiner, who played Data, I think hung with me when I was a child. And I loved Next Generation when I was young, watching him play a character that was never going to be human. And this idea, this trope, dates back to Pinocchio, really. We're talking about something that is longing to join a world that it can only exist in, with rules that were set by the people who get to live in that world. And how we push against that is having an artificial intelligent life form that at times seems more human than the people living in this dystopian society that have been so cut off from themselves by technology.
That is the trope that I think we do appreciate, though, the idea that the AI is the most human of us all.
Right, right.
But the other thing, though, is that in the example of Data and other AIs, they're always struggling to become human, but
yeah.
they didn't fall into the easy trap of trying to give Poe a body
yeah.
and let him long to be human. He just longed for connection.
Yeah.
And in the connection would find humanity.
Yeah, exactly. It's really a relationship. Based story. It's about intimacy at the mm-hmm. end of the day. There's a great quote, I think it's Junot Diaz, the author, who says, real love or intimacy, I'm paraphrasing, intimacy is letting someone else find out who you really are. And that's an idea that we played with a lot at the beginning of season one. And for me, it related directly to Falstaff's relationship with Henry or Hal and Henry parts Henry 4, parts 1 and 2, and in Henry 5, that Falstaff is a failure as a human, but Hal loves him anyway because he sees all of his failures as really what drives him to be the individual that he is.
Poe in the show mm-hmm. feels like he is introspective. He is thinking about himself. He's keeping a stock of where he is in his how he feels and how he, you know, how he is, his journey goes.
Yeah.
But Takeshi, his the Ronin that he follows.
Yeah.
Is utterly unapologetic, almost doesn't care about anything and tolerates Poe.
Yeah.
There's kind of a lapdog thing there, but I'm not comfortable with the dog or the pet metaphor.
Right, right.
It's more of a squire.
It's a bit of a squire. There's a bit of a Batman or Robin thing, I think, in the, in the minds of some of the audience members, I've been told that. Mm-hmm. Or the one that's been circulating since season two dropped was I'm a bit of the TARDIS and Takeshi's the Doctor Who. But I think at the end of the day, it goes back to intimacy between these two characters in the same way that Poe is trying to find himself through, whether it be Lizzie, his ward at one point, or whether it be Dig 301, who shows up in season two. another AI. In Takeshi, he sees a friend, and Takeshi at some point realizes that they have an intimate connection. It's season two feels a little bit like a marriage that's been around for a long time. You know, it's 30 years after season one, and these two entities have been traveling the galaxy looking for something and not finding it. And it's a bit like a husband and wife, you know, stuck at Disneyland.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there are things happening. The relationship with Miss Elizabeth, the relationship, like you just said, with Dig 301, played by Dina Shahabi, very excellently. Everyone, Poe gets to interact with people, with entities across the spectrum
yeah.
of what is available in this universe. He gets to interact with humans. He gets to interact with people in synthetic sleeves. And he has to have his own entire emotional relationship with another AI with no humans around. Mm-hmm. What does Dig 301 want? Does this show us that all the AIs want human interaction?
Well, I think in season one, we definitely saw that a lot of the AIs are have no use for humans anymore.
Yeah, they're quite disaffected.
And malicious. There's a reason why the sex clubs or some of the houses of ill repute are run specifically by AIs. They are.
It requires an emotional detachment.
Yeah, and they're tools of meths who are, you know, keeping the 99% down. Dig 301 was looking for a purpose. And it's exactly what she says, a dig without a dig, mm-hmm. because she's actually an excavator and anthropologist as an artificial intelligent life form. And she's looking for something to research or fix or and she finds that in Poe.
Exactly. She finds it as a plot device in like the plot and the things that everyone else is trying to excavate. But it is, in fact, Poe and his pain that she's trying to go and excavate and dig into.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very specific too. That's a testament to good writing, considering that we jump so far away from the source material, which I think you have to do for mm-hmm. Television or film. It's a lovely thing to see and to get to act such good storytelling. And we were lucky to have Alison Chapker as our showrunner this year, helping us along the journey.
When you need to focus on building, do you want to get bogged down by your database? MongoDB is an intuitive, flexible document database that lets you get to building. MongoDB's document model is a natural way to represent data so you can focus on what matters. MongoDB Atlas is the best way to use MongoDB. It's a global cloud database service that gives you all of the developer productivity of MongoDB, plus the added simplicity of a fully managed database service. You can get started free with MongoDB Atlas at mongodb.com/atlas. So speaking about the acting aspect of it specifically, how do you know when you're doing this that it works? I mean, I'm sure that there's table reads, but how did you know it would work?
Yeah, I don't. I never know. I'm terrified. And I would come home to my wife every night and say, I'm going to get laughed at. This is the worst acting I've ever done in my life. It's a leap of faith a lot of ways. I'm a theater actor, so the suspending disbelief is pretty easy for me, or at least that's the thing I have the most joy in doing. So I have a good time with it. And it's a Shakespearean story. It's larger than life, hopefully, that we don't turn into such a dystopian society such as this. And you step out on the stage, or in this case, in front of a camera, and hope that someone understands your struggle and your wants as a character when they watch the show. And you hope that you get to tell a story like we did in season two of a character struggling with mental instability.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are a guest teaching artist and you've taught Shakespeare. As you said, you're a stage actor. What is the difference between presenting and projecting out to a room of 100 or 300 where you've got about 50 feet of emotional radius?
Yeah.
While Altered Carbon, tens of millions of people are watching it right now. Are you acting for those tens of millions of people? Or are you acting for the people on set? Is the set a stage?
Yeah, sometimes. We had such a great crew and they respond so well as audience members that it really does help you as an actor. The Canadian crews in general in Vancouver and British Columbia have been stellar. And not just because they laugh at your jokes, but they are responsive and are nurturing and helping you as a performer. I think the difference between being on a stage that is in front of 1,400 live people, and the difference between being in front of a camera is just that. It's a camera is basically an intimate one person. It doesn't mean that the size of the performance changes sometimes, because if you watch some of my favorite actors, Philip Seymour Hoffman comes to mind right away. Joaquin comes to mind. All of these guys sometimes are enormous with their performance, but because they're so grounded in front of the camera, it reads and comes across as being captivating and really propelling as far as telling the story goes.
There are moments, there are appropriate pauses, there are seconds that extend, they feel like a second is a minute. There are moments where you're using your face, you're twitching, you're moving in some way. How do you know that the showrunner, the director, the editor is going to give you that space to emote? Because they seem to give you lots of space, and that's why I think people are connecting with Poe.
Yeah, the gift of having bosses and collaborators that have faith in you as an artist is, it sounds so pretentious, but it's true, that they give you that space is, it's so far and few between as far as being a working actor to get it. And it's the joy of streaming services now. You don't have as many suits on set saying what the audience needs, because while there are still notes, they're not focus groups. They're not playing to some common denominator that seems to be what would sell soap at the end of the day.
Right.
That's what network television really is.
So you've been a working actor for many, many years. Have there have been suits on set versus this concept of a showrunner? I've only heard that word showrunner in the last, like since The Wire.
Right. Yeah. David Simon really did break out as the showrunner. And now there's so many people who have a distinct vision for their show. And it did usher in the era of the golden age of television, some people call it. The Wire being one of the best examples, or The Sopranos, or there's. But if you go back and you saw what Alan Alda did with MASH, he really was a showrunner back then. The television shows that are procedurals, that while they still have a showrunner running them, they are exactly that. They are a system of numbers that you put together, and you make something that is more like instant baked brownies as opposed to from scratch. And
right.
Showrunners provide a common thread and vision that gives everybody the basis of how to tell the story the best to serve the artistic vision of what the showrunner wants.
Right. And it also allows, and this is a wonderful thing, it allows a diversity of directors to come in.
Yeah.
And you might watch 10 episodes of something and you go, wow, season 7 had a flavor to it. What was that? Oh, that was guest director.
Yeah.
Who the showrunner then, you know, gave their break, and they as opposed to having the same director for an entire season.
Yeah, or having a different director every episode. We had the gift of doing block shooting, and each director for the second season and the first season, for the most part, got 2 episodes. So you really build a rapport, because you're really making a 2-hour movie with these people. And like MJ Bassett directed 3 and 4 of season 2, and she's a powerhouse as far as vision and energy and pushing a story along and challenging you as an actor, asking more of you than you thought you were willing to be able to do. In that gift of having a director who is asking for better storytelling continually on a daily basis, only happens now, for me, at least, on streaming service television. Mm-hmm.
When we as lay people who basically see the behind-the-scenes stuff at the end of the DVD, and we see whatever the YouTube behind-the-scenes is, we see only the thing that you put on film,
yeah.
And then we see a still of you standing with a director. Presumably, they're giving you notes.
Right.
That can't be the complete extent of that. I mean, it's like you kill it, you do a whole great scene, and they go, oh, let me give a couple of notes, and then do it all over again.
Yeah.
Are there – when are the times that they give you that? Do you dress up as Poe and sit at a conference table and try to like, this is who I'm thinking I'm going to be today?
That's funny. Close to it. I mean, you do the table read usually. But it starts early in the morning, script in hand, walking through the scene on a set. I come to the set with my own idea of what I want to do. I luckily was gifted with directors who were willing to listen to me and my ideas. And sometimes, and I've worked with directors in the past, who just throw out everything the actor wants and they come up with what they want. And it ends up being stilted. It ends up being a little fragmented. And I can see it in performances when I watch it. The notes as part of the process during the day, once you build a language with a director, like Kieran, who directed one and two of season two, he's an Irishman with a brilliant sense of humor and could just take the piss out of me, and then immediately I would understand, okay, I need to lighten this up, brighten it a little bit. And it's also a relationship of trust. It's the same thing of like you project managing your own team or having a relationship at work with people who you expect them to show up on time and do what they're asked to do. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. There were a number of, I wouldn't say Easter eggs, but there were a little bit of subtle sprinkles and flavor in the hotel, in the background. There were moments that you needed to pause and go, look at that. Did someone just put that on a shelf?
Yeah.
Or and you also did other things. And for example, the eye twitch.
Yeah.
Was that real or was that an effect? That's
I'm doing it right now.
Yeah,
actually.
He's doing it right now. So the thing that's weird about this is that I tried this morning in my research. I'm like, can I move one eye without even a hint of squinting on the other eye? And
yeah.
It's freaking hard. It's one of those things you're not supposed to be able to do. You remove a couple of frames, and that's a really interesting effect to show a glitch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we came up in the first season, we came up with the idea, actually it was on the fly. Not on the fly for me. I rehearse everything beforehand before I get to work. And so I had come up with this idea of downloading data and having some way of showing it.
Right.
And then we got to season two when the deterioration of Poe's mental state is happening and how you illustrate that. Well, the watch helps a lot, the ticking sound. Mm-hmm. And then the idea of, oh, there's a problem with the connection. Synapses aren't firing in the same way, just to make it tangible to humans. Mm-hmm. And it was me watching a documentary. I think it's called Me and My Mum or My Mum. I'm not sure which, but it's about a woman and her mother and their relationship with her mother's Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And it's a British documentary. It's on YouTube, actually, and I suggest everybody watching it. But this woman's mother laughed and hysterically, and I think it's a Samuel Beckett quote, laughing wild like it's severest woe. And it's this beautiful moment of trying to figure out how you deal with losing your faculties. And the twitch was part of that on the outside, but the laughing part and trying to find some joy in it was something that we tried to instill in season two, and hopefully we did.
Yeah, there was a, I'm not sure the right way to pronounce it, the pathos of, there was a pain in the, I'm a freaking AI.
Yeah.
This is the value I provide. I am this hotel, but honestly, I am only my mind, and now I can't even have that.
Yeah.
And then the thing that he needed to hold on to was his memories of his friends, and particularly Miss Elizabeth, and to reboot would have been a death. And now, popping all the way off the stack to the beginning of the original conversation, this is a show where everyone lives forever, where real death is a rare thing. It is a dangerous thing. And Poe is the thing that should live forever. Of all the things that should live forever, of all the useless meths that have no value, they should not live forever. Poe should, and then he has to die multiple times and lose himself.
Yeah.
Was really the moral core of the entire thing.
That's interesting. I think season two is definitely a love story, and it's a love story not only for Takeshi and Kel, the A story, you might want to call it, of the show, but for Poe and what it means to have love of your past, love of your memories, which is something we all deal with every day.
Well, because the memories that he was building were the emotional baggage that he was packing. His whole life was figuring out this puzzle, and I think it was not just that he wanted. Poe did not want to lose his memories, but he didn't want to lose the learnings of the human connection. He'd have to start all over again.
Yeah, yeah. I had this college professor, Brian Johnston, a brilliant man. He was like the world's foremost scholar on Ibsen. Talk about an obscure, specific endeavor. But he always had this wonderful way of losing his train of thought and then getting it back, mm-hmm. because it was a bit of a reminiscence of I am a brilliant, capable man, but really at the end of the day, I'm a sack full of memories that hopefully someone at some point will go back and remember. It's tragic, and we deal with it, especially now, as watching the baby boomers age, watching our parents fade.
Yeah, I have gone and done recordings of grandparents and my parents.
Just doing this.
You know, if ever there was a person that you could record without their consent, it would be like your dad. And you just got to like push the record on the iPhone. I'm like, how's it going, Dad? What's going on?
Yeah.
How did you meet Mom again? And then you want to capture those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's vital for us too, as people who want richer and deeper lives. You know, you need to seek the, not only the comfort of memory, but the pathos, as you said earlier, and it's all a learning experience, hopefully.
So as we close our show here, what do you do with this character that you love where we don't know if season 3 or 4 or 10 is a thing?
Mm-hmm.
There are shows on television and on streaming services that have 11 seasons that we didn't ask for.
Yeah.
Actually, one of my favorite tweets that is a compliment to you was that you called the Kel and Takeshi the A story, but someone said, well, you know, the whole Takeshi thing, like the whole main character, is really just a MacGuffin to move the emotional story that is Poe forward.
That's funny. I think that, yeah, it's kind that someone said that, but I think if season 3 does happen, maybe getting back to more of a Sherlockian detective story and Watson and Holmes, and I would get back alongside Takeshi would be really fun to play. Yeah,
the buddy movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I miss that relationship a lot. We touch on it a little bit in season 2, but it would be really fun to get back and solve a crime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Chris Connor, for taking the time to chat with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Anytime.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we will see you again next week.